I'm hoping that, you know, with our questions today, we'll get some more insights from Nadine on how that actually works.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
What? Did you say Nadine?
Nadine, didn't I? Oh.
I wasn't going to say anything.
Hey everybody, Brian Collins here with another exciting episode of the Pixel Hub Podcast. With me as always, Dan Lefebvre, who I'm going to predict is doing good today.
Let's see. I'm doing great.
He's doing great, folks.
That was
fantastic.
Cheesy.
And I know why he's doing great. We've got a great show for you today. We're going to be interviewing a VFX supervisor from Method Studios, Nordine Rahali. And Nordine has worked on a lot of really big VFX-heavy movies for the studio, including the latest San Andreas. Mm-hmm. He's also worked on Into the Storm, Hercules, RoboCop, Riddick, you name it. Even Iron Man 3, he's had a hand in doing supervisory work there.
Yeah, and even before being a supervisor, I mean, he's been in the industry for, what, like 2 decades.
Mm-hmm.
Came up as an effects artist. If you just look at his IMDb page, which we'll put a link to in the show notes, there's a really impressive body of work that he's been involved in as he's gone throughout his whole career.
Yeah, also including technical director positions, as well as like he also worked for Digital Domain, which we'll probably talk to him about that. So, you know, it's always really exciting to talk to VFX supervisors just to see the road that they went down, how their career path and how they started, what got them motivated and what continues to motivate them. And just like, what's the daily grind
what is,
like?
What would you say it is you do here?
What is it that you do?
No, it's always great to hear from people with his type of expertise. Mm-hmm. So I'm real excited to hear his opinions and kind of his pathway.
Yeah, it's going to be great. Well, without further ado, let's go ahead and talk to Nordine Rahali. But first, a message from our sponsor. Do you feel uninspired as a digital artist? Has your imagination taken a vacation? Are you in a creative rut and spending too much time staring blankly at your monitor? If these descriptions are familiar, you're probably suffering from a common ailment known as creative block.
Having creative block can cause negative psychological effects, as well as affect you financially. Loss of creativity at the office could mean losing a bid and maybe even your job.
So don't find yourself depressed and homeless. Get Collier's Creative Juices Extract, an aromatherapy essential oil that's carefully designed to get you back in the creative saddle.
Collier's Creative Juices Extract is formed from an almost scientific process that mixes virgin skunk urine, gorgonzola cheese, and aged fish paste. Collier's is easy to use. Simply apply a liberal dabbing within your nasal cavity, breathe in deeply, and feel the juices flow.
You'll soon notice the sublime effects of an upsurge in creativity. Before long, your friends and coworkers will be saying, "Hey there, Picasso!" No more pulling all-nighters at the office for you anymore, Virginia Woolf. With Collier's Extract, now you'll have all the answers at the brainstorm meeting.
So grab some Collier's Extract today and smell your way back to creative potency.
Warning, side effects can include mild headaches, unwanted hair growth, leukemia, upset stomach, indigestion, abnormal vision, back pain, muscular pain or tenderness, nausea, fix it in post-traumatic stress disorder. Contact a physician immediately in the event that effects last more than 3 hours.
Well, thanks for visiting with us, Nordine. We appreciate it, you coming on the podcast here. We thought we'd start off, why don't you tell us how you got into VFX and maybe how you became a supervisor as well?
Sure. First off, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. My story is probably very different, maybe a bit unique. I originally come from an actual circus performing background. I was born and raised in the circus, believe it or not. So, I'm not sure how many people you've had on the show that can claim that, but
first.
I was at the first. Oh, okay, good. So I was a performer in the circus, and that was my life until I was mid teenager, and we kind of settled down in Toronto. That's where my mother's from, and so we had a lot of family up there. And I basically started going into, I guess, the regular, more normal you know, sort of going through school and staying kind of in one place. And from my high school, we had an Amiga lab. And, you know, this was kind of Commodore Amigas, you know, back in the early 90s. And I had just finished watching, you know, I've always been kind of fascinated by Star Wars and you know, the special effects. You know, at the time, there wasn't a lot of digital effects. Mm-hmm. And I was always, you know, I always thought that was a fascinating area. And I had recently watched The Making of the Abyss. And I was blown away. I just, you know, how they made the, you know, the water, you know, monster, that a whole liquid person. And, you know, because that's not something I'd ever seen before. You know, at the time, I thought it was absolutely realistic. And I was just so amazed by that. And so when I went to my high school, we had all this amazing Amiga computers, and they had Lightwave and a video toaster, and they had, you know, this high-end stuff that I'd never even heard of. And they had this 3D program that to me looked exactly like what I had just seen, you know, this documentary of, and no one was using it. And it blew my mind. I said, I have to learn how to use this. And so that kind of, you know, started getting me into the whole visual effects, graphics end of 3D through my high school. You know, from there, I ended up actually taking a co-op position in my senior year at a local commercial and, you know, kind of low-end film production studio, and, you know, kind of got my foot in the door that way, and you know, so kind of never looked back ever since, I guess.
What was that software you were talking about you couldn't believe people weren't using?
Well, at the time, again, this is, you know, early 90s, yeah. It was New Tech, you know, Video Toaster, which was a suite that had Lightwave, I believe. Uh-huh. You know, they had a live switching. It was very much meant for broadcast TV. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They had a 3D rendering component of that. I even think they had at the time, it was called PAR, personal something recorder. So, you know, recording video footage and being able to play it back real speed was a big deal back then. And so they had a whole dedicated piece of hardware just to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we happened to have that in my school, which was still an amazing, amazing thing to think of, you know, back then, have a school, have a whole lab of Amigas and some of that software available.
Did you become the resident expert with the software?
Very quickly, yes. I was pretty much where I lived, you know, after school as much as I could. And you know, thankfully my teacher at the time who kind of ran that program, his name was actually Howard Gross. He no longer serves there, but he was, you know, probably one of the strongest influences in my career. And, and I know many others as well that kind of went through that program.
Well, did you end up creating that monster, that water alien at the end of the abyss?
No, I didn't do at this time, there's no way I could have done that. But, you know, I ended up doing a lot of, you know, like I get Babylon inspired, Star Wars inspired things. And I'd render like spaceships and try to create planets. And, you know, I get based on some of the earlier stuff that I loved, which is Star Wars, and try to recreate some of those.
Yeah. That documentary you were talking about, The Making of the Abyss, I've seen that, and it's really, really good.
Oh, great. So, yeah, then you know what I mean.
Yeah, I know absolutely what you mean. I remember, you know, thinking, they interviewed a lot of the actors, like Mary Elizabeth Master Antonio and some of the others, and they were really adamant about this was the hardest film that they had ever worked on and probably ever would. Like it was a passageway or something, something they'd done personally.
I think it was a torture test for a lot of them.
Really. Like one of them, a couple of them almost died, right?
Exactly. Ed, I mean, there was more than one almost near death experiences. Yeah.
Oh wow.
I remember one of them, I think it might have been Ed Harris, going, I can tell people I worked on the abyss. Like, that says it all, right?
I like your little impersonation there.
Well, yeah, I'm a
professional. That's right.
And I have to ask, Nordine, what did you perform in the circus? Like, what was your act?
I was the first thing, the literal first thing I did, I was 4 years old, and I was a clown. And I played, and I always get a kick out of saying this, I played the original Mini-Me, because my dad was, you know, in the circus, you kind of do multiple acts Clown was one of the acts we did. We did other acts, but they brought me in at four as the miniature version of my dad after he gets thrown into a dryer after basically having a tussle with another laundromat person. And and I shrink, and he shrinks rather, and I come out.
Oh, nice.
I'm the original, way before Mike Myers came with his. but for the most of the years, I was actually we had a Moroccan style tumbling act. So I was an acrobat, and because I was a little guy, we would do human pyramids, and I would always get kind of tossed to the top of the pyramid, and again a lot of tumbling. Very fast paced, very entertaining act for sure.
Wow, that is quite incredible. It reminds me of the story of Buster Keaton, the silent film actor. He had a very similar childhood growing up. Have you read anything about him?
No, but I've seen many of the films, but I haven't actually read an autobiography or anything. I don't know if he has one, or maybe a biography,
Yeah, there's a lot of biographies. But his family was in vaudeville, and so he was part of the act from like you say, like three or four, and his dad would throw him around. Like at one point, even in, like the early 1910s or whatever, they were worried that he was abusing him even then.
Oh, even then.
Oh, my God. Even then. There were no rules back then.
So if they were worried about it even then, they must have been doing something.
It must have been horrible.
But I mean, no, really, it's a very different lifestyle. Yeah. And, a lot of people ask me if it was a hard lifestyle. And I always say that, I was born in it at the time and I knew no other lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it wasn't difficult. It was just, that's how we live, right? That's what life was. And it was a lot of training. It was a lot of moving around. It was a lot of injuries. And then, you train not to get injured, but, of course, accidents happen. And, I've had my fair share, even at those young ages of stills and falls, and, I've fallen in the middle of performances and had to be rushed to the hospital. And I've had all sorts of injuries, but that's just how it is. So in hindsight, it's a very difficult lifestyle, but when that's all, it's not that hard. It's just, you just get through it,
So did this in any way prepare you to become a VFX supervisor who has to walk a tight wire, a lot of times?
And this is where I think it's been a very interesting transition, because I think absolutely it did, and for me, I didn't, there's a lot of different, I guess, specialties in the field of visual effects. So, I started off as a more of a generalist. When you start out a small studio, you tend to basically, dip your head in or hand into many different disciplines, because it's small and everyone kind of used to do a lot of things. Mm-hmm. When you get to the bigger studios, they basically have people that are specialized in modeling, for example, animation, texturing, rigging, lighting, comping, effects. There's a bunch of different disciplines, and so you kind of I started to focus in on a smaller subsection of what we do, but I started off as a generalist, and my circus background, I think I have a very good sense of timing. I know how the body moves because I've had to do it all, physically. So I can quickly see animation or just, and not even just on people, but just in general, I understand how things are supposed to move and what mass does, and so I've been able to adapt that to what I do now, to kind of quickly get to why something's not looking right. A lot of times, that's what we do. It's you get something that's in that 90 percentile of looking really good, but it's not quite there, and that's usually the really hard part of figuring out, what that last 10%, what is it missing.
Yeah.
Because it's some people think it's subjective. Sometimes it is a little bit, because you're cheating physics to make an image and you're fighting that. But a lot of times it just takes an eye to go, it's because of this, and part of it is timing, part of it is animation, again, lighting and all that. All those kind of facets come in to try to take it the last 10%. So, my background, just with the performing side, I think has come is really helping me in my career. My wife's even said so, which is always a positive thing. When she
that always means it's true.
Exactly.
So what's the craziest thing that's ever happened to you as a VFX artist or supervisor?
The craziest thing? In or out of work? What are we talking about?
let's keep it to work.
Oh, geez. It's funny. That's a difficult one to answer because there's been a lot of crazy long late nights. I mean, this job is not easy, right? It definitely takes a certain personality. It takes a lot of commitment. It takes a love for the craft. Yeah. Really, to me, that's what ultimately makes them really successful at this. You know, because there's plenty of other jobs that you can go to and do a 9 to 5. You know, this is not one of them that you'll regularly be able to do that. Yeah. So, you know, I think most craziest thing. Jeez.
Has there been a particular deadline that you cut it really, really close that required a bunch of changes and craziness that happened?
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, just trying to answer that first one, really, because it is a difficult one. The craziness usually happens when you have an indecisive client, right? Mm-hmm. Where they either don't get the process, and because of that, they feel like they can make really outlandish last minute comments all the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of my kind of, I guess, personal reasons of wanting to become a supervisor was I was on the very end of that, you know, the receiving end of all those changes for a long time. Mm-hmm. And the only way that I could see trying to make that better was getting to the top so that I could, you know, have some say and some pushback with the client to try to protect all the artists downstream. Mm-hmm. You know, that was one of my personal reasons to, you know, become a supervisor was, you know, I want to try to make this better so that we can try to have a little bit of a life, still produce cool work and have fun, mm-hmm. but not necessarily, you know, get on the receiving end of, you know, mm-hmm. a painful last minute decision that really affects a lot of people, and it affects their families, yeah. affects their life. I mean, it's such a trickle down effect, you know, the domino effect. So for me, you know, just, I think, trying to climb that ladder and set those expectations with a client that doesn't understand our process very well, or, cause there's a lot of directors out there. You'd be very surprised that understand how to tell a story and have no idea how visual effects work at all. Right. Yeah. So some of them, and not by, you know, not all the time on purpose or, you know, by intention, are trying to mess us up. But because they don't understand that process, or they haven't been walked through it,
yeah.
they don't know that the comments that they're saying aren't that much of a problem,
yeah.
you know? And so they'll say something, a lot of people won't reply back, you know, it goes through the producers, it comes basically our producers scramble, we try to hit them up with the change orders so that we're protected cost-wise. But being protected cost-wise doesn't mean that you have the manpower that you can, yeah. you know, get immediately. So there's like a bunch of scrambling over a comment that might have, you know, I mean, who knows how strongly they felt about it, or if they knew that was a big deal.
Yeah.
So my job is to be there. And at that very initial point when that comment's made is, well, you know, to understand all that back-end workflow and then try to soften it, not to say no, but right. to go, well, have you thought about maybe this? Or I'm trying to see a way that doesn't totally mess us up, but still get to their vision. Right. you know, executed or at least walk them through that process. So I try to do that to varying degrees of success. It always depends on the person, but you know, that's part of the protection, trying to run the job efficiently and allow everyone to have lives. That's the goal.
What would you say was one of the biggest perks of your job?
I think it's being able to say that we get to work on all these cool films. Like, I've been able to travel the world and be on all these amazing locations and sets. I've met fantastic people that just have such an amazing wealth of knowledge. You know, I've met people that have worked on some of my favorite films, or at least really abstract films that I remember, like The Last Starfighter. You know, I mean, I remember growing up watching that, going, "Oh, that's so cool." And, I haven't watched it recently, so I have no idea if it holds up. But I remember my memory of it is really strong.
Sometimes that's best, just a limited memory.
Yeah, maybe I shouldn't watch it again. But you know, it's just been really cool to see and meet these people that have been involved in really the history of film. And a lot of films that I can directly relate to.
Yeah.
And, you know, my children, they go to school and, you know, they're so proud to be able to say that, you know, their papa worked on, you know, Harry Potter and you know, he worked on Iron Man. You know, he worked on a lot of these popular films that, that they get excited about. It brings them a lot of pride. So, you know, I think that's a pretty great reward right there.
Have you ever met anybody that worked on The Abyss?
I have not, and I've. You know what's funny? I've just missed a few people when I was at DD. So I'm still targeting that. You know? I'll eventually get there.
Now you also worked on the movie 2012, right?
Yes.
And that had some revisions to it. Do you want to tell us about that story, like what it was like, the experience was like making those changes?
Well, on 2012, just so you guys know, my involvement on that, I had just finished The Mummy 3 and G.I. Joe, and I was coming on to 2012 to basically help out, because that show had a lot of, as you said, changes. But I wasn't on it for too long. Like, I would say I was probably on it for maybe 2 months in total.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't, I didn't go through the big grind at the end. So my story of pain there will not be like others. I missed the big painful part of it. But, yeah, so maybe I can't answer your question on that directly, just because I wasn't involved as deeply.
But it's not, I mean, that movie, even, you know, coming in at the end of it, it's a great example of what you were talking about before, of how it's a trickle-down effect, and you have these changes and you have things that happen. Are there any other movies that you've worked on where you've kind of been able to help with that? I know you're constantly trying to, but what would you say you've been able to alleviate some of those changes the most? As a supervisor?
Oh, as a supervisor, I mean, I think probably the last film I've worked on is probably the best example. You know, I mean, that's a daily constant, I'm not going to say battle, because it's not that. It's just, it's a process, you know?
Sure. So it's an educational process, as you know, said. A lot of people don't know the process.
It absolutely is, yeah. And, you know, I think the crew, so we were one of the main vendors on the show. You know, you have Colin Strauss, who was the overall visual effects supervisor, and Brad Payton, who was the director. And so I was on set for just over 2 months in Australia shooting it, but I also supervised directly the LA shoot, which was only a few day shoot that we had downtown. And it was an incredibly complicated shoot, because we had, you know, limited access to airspace and also location. We're flying helicopters well below the standard, you know, height that you're allowed to fly, you know, over a downtown area.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to have lots of clearance, lots of security or police hired to block sections of the road and small windows to operate within, you know, because we had these, you know, serious helicopters flying only in some cases, you know, a couple hundred feet above a building, for example. So it was all very close proximity. And ultimately, you know, all of those plates, for the most part, became reference, because we did so much in the destruction side of it that there was very little of the original plate photography that we could use. But it was invaluable, and the reason I pushed so hard to at least try to capture the original previous angles was because I knew we could use a base layer of that for lighting and possibly some extending, you know, extension on the background for matte painting. And it worked out incredibly well. It was just an very, very difficult thing to organize and to get everyone on board to do, because, you know, as soon as something gets really difficult and you think you're running out of time, the the very common feeling is, well, you don't really need that. That's going to be an LCG, so we'll just, you know, they'll just nix it. They'll just not shoot it. Mm-hmm. And my whole point is I need it at least for a reference, because what you're giving me is something real that I can try to match to. And this is my personal subtle way of getting it in there. We won't have a digital version of that until months and months and months later after that plate's been shot. And so I know, because of the process, what they're going to put into the edit will be that plate. And so what's going to happen is they at least have a real live plate that they're putting in as a stand-in until our effects start getting there. And why that's important is because they're seeing something that we're inevitably matching to in terms of look. So there's not the disconnect of going from like a pre-vis shot to a visual effects shot and then having subjective ideas of what the lighting or anything else needs to be. So for me, these are like subtle ways I was trying to plant the seeds of, this gives us reference, it gives us something to match to, and you've been seeing that backplate, and now you're seeing a destructive backplate instead of the giant leap from a very rough video game previs to a visual effects shot, where you can start to, you know, a lot of times the director or other people will just have subjective ideas on what they think it should look like rather than what it actually should look like because of those. So, you know, those are things that definitely help steer, I think, you know, the expectations.
Now, was Method, were they responsible for that one really long shot in San Andreas where she's walking out the door and the building comes falling down, and then there's a pan over to the right, and there's a swimming pool that's...
Oh, yeah.
Did you guys do that shot? I can't remember.
Yeah, I'll just explain briefly. It is, I think it was over a 3-minute shot.
Yeah.
You know, it's meant to be one take. It involved, the overall quick version of this is, it's the POV of The Rock flying in a helicopter towards downtown L.A., specifically towards the Standard, where he's trying to rescue his wife, Emma. So she's trying to get to the roof, while everyone else's instinct is to try to leave the building and escape. So we follow the camera as an aerial shot through the windows as it's shattering into the restaurant while this giant earthquake, you know, 9.0 is striking, and it becomes a steady cam shot following her. She's trying to get to a stairwell, opens the door, you know, as she just saw some people leave, and the entire building shakes and we lose that section. So that section of the building's gone. We see the street, she closes. Then she runs to the other stairwell, opposite side of the building, gets to the roof, and pretty much in an environment at that time, you know, she's watching the buildings, which are all dwarfing hers, because the Standard is really just a mid-rise building amongst, you know, a bunch of high-rise buildings. And so we're seeing her POV, all this stuff falling over. There's a pool sloshing around and going crazy. And we see that building's also starting to collapse. We follow the POV, the camera as it looks around her feet, starts cracking the cement. And then she plummets through, I think, 3 or 4 stories of the Standard as the top section collapses. The camera pulls out, tilts up, and we see that I guess The Rock is now flying in his helicopter, again, all CG. And then that's the end of that 3-minute piece. It was the most challenging shot I've ever worked on, because all the complexity that I just described, and it being one nonstop shot. And that was a hard shot.
So what is the particular issue that the long take causes for VFX?
I think a lot of times you can hide things in an edit in terms of shortcuts, right? Like if you have a building collapsing and it's an action shot, you may only need to show the building for, you know, 48 to 60 frames. And so you only need to do part of the collapse. The next time you see that building, it might only need to be on the ground and, you know, destroyed.
Okay.
When you have a long shot, you got to watch that entire process happen. And, you know, where something might have looked good for those 60 frames, maybe the sim or maybe the lighting or maybe something else, just starts to break. And so you really start, you have to build it much more realistically so that it can feel realistic through a longer component. It just takes a lot more time.
Okay.
And it's a lot more complex to do.
Now that pool with the water sloshing up and down, that was CG?
It was all CG, yeah.
Okay. we had a yep. I had said that in an article once, and somebody commented on our forum saying, well, I worked on that movie and that was real. And then somebody else said, well, no, actually, really? I worked on the movie and it was fake.
There was an online argument about it. That's great.
Yeah.
That is funny. No, so just so you know, when we get to the roof, and it's her, you know, so basically when she comes out of that door, mm-hmm. and she looks up at the Paul Hastings, you know, and the pool, everything in that environment is CG, except for the back of her head. That was all that was left. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah. There's a lot. And I know the artist that worked on that pool for a very long time. Maybe he was the one that commented that.
Just stirring the pot.
He was saying it should have been real.
Yeah. So, what's a problem that maybe that you or your team have solved that you're most proud of?
I think really, you know, I'm always amazed when you get a large group, because that's what these become, mm-hmm. of people that take changes and are all working towards that same goal and are able to turn things around so quickly. I don't know. It might sound a bit corny, but you know, I think it's always amazing when you see a bunch of people work towards a goal and be adaptable. And you know, everyone is showing that love and commitment that you have, you know, and it's a great thing to see, because the results show when you have it kind of a whole machine moving together, all those people moving towards singles. I think personally for me, it's just watching that happen. It's watching all the curveballs of a production being thrown. And, you know, again, me at the top when I'm running a show, I try to absorb as many of the ones as you can. There will be some that get missed and you have to get the crew to work on it. And everyone doing it, you know, as much as they can with a positive attitude and really producing some incredible work, you know. Like, I think some of the technology that, just again, using the last show as an example, San Andreas, that we came up with to do that, there was just some really, you know, brilliant people that we had working in two locations. So we had people in Vancouver and people in LA, you know, working all on, in some cases, on the exact same shots, just doing different components of the same shots. And, you know, I'm really proud of that, you know, like getting these teams internationally kind of, I think, perform and cooperate at a high level. I think it's an amazing thing to see.
Yeah, it's something kind of along that I've always kind of been curious, maybe get your take on, is the teamwork that it takes to create this stuff, as you said, is amazing. And as you're working on a project like this, I'm sure there's a camaraderie that happens. You start to, as everybody's working towards the same goal. So in the middle of a production, do you tend to not try to bring new people in to hire new artists? Or if you do, kind of what do you look for when you do that to help people to, you know, hit the ground running? Or do you generally kind of wait between until you're between projects to bring people on and kind of get them up to speed? And, as far as that's concerned?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I think there's that balance that you need to do, right? When you're in the middle, like that battle right at the end, and you know, everyone put in a lot of time for it, you know, sometimes an unforeseen change comes and you just need extra manpower to finish it. So depending on what that is, you know, a lot of times you can get it from within the studio from another show, you know, so they're still at least familiar with the team. If that doesn't work out, you know, we definitely do hire from outside as needed, and we have relationships. I mean, that's the one thing, I guess, it's just the industry that we have is not huge, right? So at some point, even if we haven't worked with someone directly, someone probably on our production has. Mm-hmm. So there's, you know, you get the feedback, you know, how they performed in others, other shows with people that you know and respect, and you kind of, you know, you figure it out that way. But It is. You never know if they're going to gel with the current crew in the same way that maybe they did in another place. And so it's a little bit of a risk. But, you know, I think most of the time, the amount of work outweighs the potential risk of someone not working. Because ultimately, most everyone that's in this business that's been in it for a while, is, you know, they're all pretty professional. It's just a matter of, is the personality going to work more than anything, you know? But what I look for personally when hiring, if the show crunch is not, you know, in the equation, you know, for me, given my upbringing, which I explained, you know, a hardworking attitude, you know, someone that is positive and just try, you know, is willing to do what it takes to get it done and has that energy, it's something I personally relate to, you know, just the, you know, someone with a strong hustle, strong drive. And then the other point I would say is people with really good attention to detail, because I can't explain how many times, again, it's being able to have that eye that takes something from 90% to, to 100, you know, I think a lot of that for me, at least, is just looking at the details. And it is a skill. It definitely is. Not everyone has it. That's why you have supervisors and such that can help guide artists that are very good at their craft, but maybe not, they just can't take it. The last 10 is to explain how to take it there. And, you know, but I think having an attention to detail, just really understanding motion, lighting, and figuring out, like, looking at reference and understanding why what you're doing doesn't look like what the reference is, what those subtleties are, is a very big part, I think, of being very successful at this job. So I look for the drive, I look for the attention to detail. And actually, the third point I'll say is just being able to problem solve, you know, like people that break down a large problem into bite-sized, you know, doable chunks and plan a strategy. And I see a lot of people come in that are given a task that overwhelms them, and they sometimes shut down, like they don't know which area to tackle, so they tend to kind of tackle everything but not get anywhere because everything is barely being, you know, moved, instead of looking at the large picture, the big picture, and breaking down that problem to something smaller. And again, I think problem solving in that way is something that relates to a lot of other fields, not just ours, but it's definitely a good skill to have.
Have you ever hired anybody else with circus background?
Funny you should say that.
Oh, really?
Fire eater, juggler.
So there's actually 4 points. One of them is.
I'll give you a very funny story because, I don't know what the chances of this happening are. So when I came to L.A. for the first time and I started at DD on my very first day, I was joined by, like, you know, there was a group of us that were going through orientation there. Mm-hmm. And one of my neighbor, the guy who was sitting right next to me, he's this French guy, and we start, you know, we get along, we start hitting it off, and we start talking a little bit about our history, and he's hired at DD on the same day, and in France, he was in the circus. I nearly lost it because I was like, in all these years, I, you know, never meet anyone. And then I'm sitting next to a guy hired at DD that we both moved into the country. And what are the chances that he's in the industry and had a circus background as well? So I didn't hire him, but I thought that was worth mentioning. So.
Did they sit you next to each other on purpose? They knew, like, at some point these guys will figure it out.
I don't know, the stars aligned or something. Actually, it's funny because he's still a good mate of mine, and he's at Method now, so we're still very much in touch. He was the CG supervisor on San Andreas.
Oh, okay, cool.
So,
cool.
Yeah, he also has a circus. Yeah, he wasn't born in it, but he performed for years as also an acrobat. So.
Well, there had
so
to
very
be
a, very funny.
There had to be a moment, I think, where in your life where you were going, I want to do this. I want to be in the VFX industry for some reason, whatever it might be. Maybe to, you know, see your name in the credits or something like that, you know, be part of a team or something. And then once you achieved that goal, there had to be something else beyond that to motivate you to keep on going. So my question is, what was that first thing that made you say, you know, this is what I want to do with my life? And then how do you after you got that, how do you continue to motivate yourself? What motivates you?
I think that's also a great question. I think the first thing, like, you know, coming out of high school, because that's what I did. I graduated high school and got right into the industry. I think it was just, first off, working with computers and doing something that I thought was the coolest thing ever. You know, it's like, oh my God, I'm working on the software that they use for the Abyss. Like, come on. And then from there, I think that next step was, you know, my employer, seeing that I was really hungry and just kept feeding me more and more difficult things. Mm-hmm. And so they were all little challenges to me that I kept wanting to figure out complete. And one of the first things that I did was a spot for TSN, which is it's basically like Sports Network in Canada.
Okay.
And it was for the Sky Dome, which I think is now called the Rogers Center. And you know, they had the Jumbotron, so they had a very particular, you know, resolution. It was a massive screen, and I did a little spot just for that Jumbotron. And that thing aired for years. And every time I'd go to a game or my friends would go to a game, they would, you know, let me know that they'd seen my spot on there. And I thought that was the coolest thing. I'm like, oh my God, you know, I'm working on this thing that, you know, literally hundreds of thousands of people are going to see all the time when they go to these games. How cool is that? Mm-hmm. And then my next logical step was, you know, doing films and getting credits in films and feeling, you know, showing my family, and of course they were so proud to be able to see my name. And on some movies, I would be like, "No, don't bother watching the movie. It's all right.
Just watch the credits."
Yeah. And well, son, we really want to support you. No, I totally understand. I love you guys for it, but you don't need to. You're not supporting me directly by watching this movie. Trust me. So. You know, I had some of those, like I think probably everyone does. And then, of course, you know, as some of the bigger films came out that I definitely wasn't cringing at, you know, it brought my family a lot of pride. And you know, I was also proud to have been part of the film. And then I think as, you know, because I'm at 20 years now since I've entered the industry. So it's been a long time. You know, now credits and such are not, they don't mean the same thing to me anymore personally. You know, just cause I've been doing it for so long. I think the satisfaction that I get now is the connections that I make with people and creating art that I'm really proud of, you know, like just challenging, I think, visuals that people are blown away by that have a team that went through a journey together that hopefully was a real positive one. And so, you know, that's kind of my goal, is to try to run those shows. Again, I think it comes a little bit full circle to why I wanted to become a supervisor. I'm still trying to make that all mesh, you know. And again, it's not a one person, you know, job at all. Like, you know, I'm definitely one of the figureheads into making that happen, but that's a partnership with the producer. That's a partnership with the supervisors you have under you. That's a partnership with the leads that are under the supervisors. That all has to kind of gel fairly well together so that the artists that are then under the leads, you know, are all kind of working together as a solid type group, you know. But again, it all, to me, it comes from the top, you know. If that's one of my goals and that the producer is on board and they're trying to aim for that same thing, then you surround yourself with supervisors that are going to be kind of like-minded and pushing towards those singles. Right. You know, so to me, it's not an accident that those things happen. I think, you know, it's a design, and if you get the right people, you're pushing towards a similar goal, then generally I think you're going to get a good chunk of it.
Yeah. And it takes some strong leadership to get it there. And it's obvious, Nordine, that you guys do a great job, both at the execution of these effects, but also obviously from your leadership, from people like you that they have there. And we really appreciate you coming on and telling us these great stories about how you got started. And they're very beneficial,
I think,
to people, you know, who are not only supervisors, but artists under them and leads who get that perspective.
Mm-hmm. My pleasure. It's been a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun sharing the story, and hopefully it's entertaining to a few.
for sure.
All right. Well, thanks for talking with us again, and good luck in the future and with your next project, buddy.
Cheers. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, that was VFX supervisor and circus performer, Nordine Rahali.
He's had quite the career, hasn't he?
Yeah, that was good. That was interesting. It was probably one of the more interesting sort of "this is where I came from" story.
Yeah,
that I think we've heard so far.
First circus performer, although I guess to our knowledge, if you've been on our show before. And you started off in the circus, by all means, let us know.
Let us know.
We want to hear that.
But I found it really interesting how he attributed that part of his childhood and growing mm-hmm. up and the ability to be an acrobat to benefiting him with the way that things should move, the human body or things that collapse or something like that. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, I think it kind of goes to show no matter what your background is, as an artist, you're tasked with basically recreating something from the real world, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it be in a VFX movie like San Andreas, where it's actually in the real world, right? Or highly stylized in an animated film, even if it's an alien world, there's going to be elements that ground it to the real world. So as an artist, no matter what your background is, you can pull from that to help inspire you, but also to help move you forward and to help help become a better artist. As he was saying, where moving around and performing in the circus, well, I know how the body works because I had to do all this, right? And I had to move around and that's just...
I know how sawdust is supposed to
I know,
expand
yeah.
in the air when thrown from a bucket by the clown.
Right, but you say that, but it wouldn't be surprising when a building falls, right? What comes out but dust and all this stuff?
All
maybe that's where
away.
You get it. Well, and the people, hopefully. But you never know where you're going to draw inspiration from. It's a long, drawn-out way of saying that, but that's kind of what I was getting to. Is you never know where you're going to find that inspiration. And so I think as an artist, it's important to continue to look for that and to recognize that and use that to help further your career and to help you become a better artist rather than just saying, he could have very easily said, well, I was in the circus. I had nothing to do with this. And so it's not going to help me whatsoever. But
which would have been a very reasonable thing.
It would have been
a
very reasonable thing to think, right? Oh yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't think of something further from VFX than being in the
circus. There may be someone listening to this who might be like working at a fast food place and think the same thing.
Sure, yeah.
Right? But your point is that you never know.
You never know, right? So use every single opportunity and get everything that you can in order to push yourself forward and become a better artist.
Yeah, and I think that people who tend to do that will have the qualities that he talked about in
having
in
that drive
writers,
that
drive and he didn't use the word, but I got the sense that one of the qualities was autonomy, which is something that most people who are hiring others to do, and it's sort of an ironic quality because you're hiring an artist to work on a team in collaboration with others, but you have to depend upon them being autonomous, meaning you say this needs fixed.
Yeah,
and you don't have to sit there and hold their hand, that you can trust them to go and figure it out themselves, that they can think their way through it, they can problem solve, they have critical skills, and they have perseverance, which you need, and I think you touched on most of those.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I didn't think about it that way, but when he's talking about the problem solving, that's exactly what that is. It's we have this problem or this challenge that we need to overcome, and we need to be able to rely on you to take that on and do it and come back with a solution that's going to do that. I think something else that he really hit on that I thought was interesting was being able to break things down, because it can be so easy to look at a problem, especially when you're dealing with a VFX heavy movie right. like that, you know, building that CG pool, something like that. It's just a massive task. So, I mean, it's where do you start? But you have to start somewhere.
Yeah.
And so finding that place of, okay, I'm going to start here and start to build that out and start to build that out. But then sometimes too, knowing that maybe that wasn't the right place to start and going back, and that's kind of where that problem solving comes in of maybe this, maybe this didn't work this way. Well, that's fine. Let's try it this way. Okay. Let's try it this way and working to solve that.
It really is the hardest part about anything is just starting.
Yeah.
I mean, we get the most anxious, the most fearful, and the most like unsure of ourselves in the beginning, and we hesitate.
Yeah.
And it's almost impossible to me to start in the wrong place, because even if it's farther from another destination where, you know, you're at least way closer than you would have been if you'd have continued to procrastinate because you were unsure of yourself. Sometimes you just got to get on with it.
Yeah, no, exactly. And there's one of the articles on our blog, actually. Man, I wish I remembered exactly which one it was. But yeah, it was kind of the point of it was just start, like start creating art. And you'll find your way, right? Sure. And just keep at it and keep at it. But like you said, there's just start. Yeah, that's the hardest part. But
it is.
Sometimes you just have to dive in and just start and let the problem solving and the solutions come. Keep at it. You know, don't quit, obviously. But yeah.
And I was really, really happy to find out that the swimming pool scene was actually CG.
Yes. We'll put a link to the show notes in of the comments there. But yes, fully CG, not fake. Or not, sorry, it is fake, not real.
Oh, now we're already confusing.
Now we're already confusing, yeah. No. I wish, just like, yeah.
I assumed it wasn't real, but it's nice to get someone to clarify that.
Yeah.
Someone who was actually there working on it.
Yeah,
that must
exactly.
have been a hell of a scene, too. I mean, that was really interesting. And I asked him, how does a long take affect the difficulty level of VFX? Which he made complete sense what he said, because you can hide so many things in that. You know, 'cause, you know, during the cut, there's a certain amount of intermittent action that we will accept as viewers as not existing.
Know? Yeah.
And that makes sense that if you don't have to fill in those gaps, that it's going to take you less time and you probably can hide more things. And I'd really never thought of that before.
No, that makes, I hadn't thought of it either, but it makes perfect sense. I mean, ultimately, VFX is finding out what you can hide and what you have to actually create. And if you can hide things and not have to create them, then you'll be able to spend more time on the things you do. You do have to. So, like you're saying, you cut away. The audience is going to assume that there's time there that's happened while you're looking at something else. And then you cut back and you just assume that things have continued to fall or crumble or whatever. Yeah. So,
yeah, it was a really, really good interview.
Yeah, I learned a lot.
If you've got any questions, comments, suggestions for other episodes, or maybe you just feel enraged and want to yell at us, reach out to us at our email address, pixelhub@pluralsight.com.
Or if you want to tell the world how awesome we are, hop over to iTunes, leave a rating and review that will make us proud. Thanks for listening.